Hello, my fellow true crime enthusiasts. I'm your host, Julia, and for today's case, we're heading to Texas. Before I tell you about it, though, we have got some patrons to thank. So, big shout out to Charlotte and Eileen, who both signed up to be patrons this week. Thank you so much for supporting the show, and I hope that extra content keeps you busy for a while. Now, fair warning. Today's case may keep you up at night, as it's more baffling than any other case. In fact, it's three times as baffling. Because how do not one, not two, but three young girls vanish as if they've dropped off the face of the earth without any answers? Today we're going to talk about the disappearance of the Fort Worth trio. Our story starts in Fort Worth, Texas, during the Christmas season of 1974. 17-year-old Mary Rachel Trelisa, who went by Rachel, wanted to do some last-minute Christmas shopping, as I'm sure we've all done at some point. Me, you couldn't pay me to go to a mall around Christmas time, but Rachel wanted to make the best of her winter break. Rachel was the middle child in her family. She had a younger brother, Rusty, and an older sister, Deborah, both of whom she was close with. However, Rachel didn't live at home with her parents and siblings. Despite being only 17, Rachel was already married and living with her husband, 21-year-old Tommy Trelisa. While this seems strange now, I imagine in the 70s it wasn't as taboo to get married that young. What was strange about this couple, though, was how they met. See, Rachel had met Tommy when Tommy was engaged to her older sister, Deborah. However, after Deborah and Tommy ended things, Rachel found herself crushing on her sister's ex-fiancé, and a romance bloomed. Despite this weird situation, though, Rachel and Deborah were still incredibly close, and Deborah said that there was no animosity between the two of them. Quote, "We had a special bond," end quote, Deborah recalls. The girls were on such good terms that apparently it wasn't even weird when Deborah moved in with the couple while she was looking for a new apartment. So on Monday, December 23rd, Rachel planned to do some last-minute shopping and asked her new roomie, her sister Deborah, to come along with her. But Deborah told Rachel that she was just too tired and that she wanted to sleep in a bit. With Deborah passing up her invitation, Rachel decided to ask one of her friends if she wanted to go. Her friend was 14-year-old Lisa Renee Wilson. Just like Rachel, Lisa Renee Wilson chose to go by her middle name and was simply just known as Renee Wilson. Rachel and Renee had been family friends for years. Their two families regularly did activities together, like camping or fishing trips. And despite the 3-year age difference, the girls were really close. That morning, Renee was having breakfast at her grandma's house, as she would regularly stay there while her parents were at work. And this was actually a great setup for Renee because her grandmother lived across the street from her boyfriend, Terry Mosley. Renee was apparently crazy about Terry, and the two had just started to get serious, as that same morning, Terry had surprised her with a promise ring to signify that the two would be together forever. Sounds a lot cuter than my 14-year-old relationship. Anyway, Renee was really excited about the promise ring and was just having a really great morning. So when Rachel invited her to go shopping, Renee eagerly accepted the invite. However, she told Rachel that she couldn't be out late though, as she and Terry were going to attend a Christmas party together. She told her friend about the ring and how excited she was to show it off at the party that night. And the two girls agreed that Rachel would drop Renee home at 4 p.m., leaving her lots of time to do her hair and makeup and what have you. As the two girls got ready to go, Renee went across the street to her boyfriend Terry's house to invite him to come along. But Terry declined, as he was going to go visit a friend in the hospital that day. However, it was then that Terry's 9-year-old sister overheard the conversation. When Julianne Mosley found out that Renee was going to the mall, she begged her to let her come along. Both of her siblings and parents were going to be out of the house all day, and she didn't want to sit home alone, she told Renee. According to Terry, Renee didn't really seem keen to drag a 9-year-old around all day, so she told Julianne that she could come only if her mother said yes. All the while, Renee is kind of secretly hoping that Mrs. Mosley won't let her daughter come with them. And just to be clear, this wasn't in a mean or malicious way. I think Terry and Renee were probably just joking around about who was going to have to take care of Julianne that day. You know, when you're 14, you don't really want a 9-year-old hanging out with you. At first, Renee gets the answer that she expected. Mrs. Mosley tells Julianne that she can't go. She said Julianne didn't have any money to spend, so what was the point of even going? But again, the 9-year-old girl told of how she didn't want to be home alone all day, and eventually her mother caved. After all, Mrs. Mosley knew Renee well because she was dating her son, so she figured it wouldn't be a problem if Julianne tagged along with the two older girls. Before hanging up the phone, Mrs. Mosley told her daughter that she had to be back for 6 p.m. for dinner. Renee assured her that this wasn't going to be an issue because she and Rachel had already agreed to be back by 4 p.m. so she could get ready for this Christmas party. Just before noon, Rachel pulled up in her 1972 Oldsmobile 98 to pick up Renee and Julianne. Then they drove off, headed to Seminary South Shopping Center, just a 10-minute drive away. On the way, the girls made a quick stop at the Army-Navy store to pick up a pair of jeans that Renee had put on layaway. The clerk remembers that the two older girls came inside. Julianne had probably stayed in the car. Rachel and Renee seemed happy and relaxed. They simply picked up what they needed and got back into the car. Shortly after, the girls arrived at the mall and shopped around. Witnesses would later report seeing them inside. As it got later into the afternoon, Terry waited patiently for his girlfriend to arrive home with his little sister. But as time passed, Terry got more and more concerned. He knew how badly Renee wanted to go to this party. There's no way she would have been late. At the same time, Rachel's husband Tommy was also becoming concerned. Tommy then called Rachel's parents to ask if they knew where she was. When Rachel's mom found out that she hadn't arrived home yet, she assumed her daughter probably had some car trouble. Remember, this is a time with no cell phones. So Rachel's parents drive out to the mall and look around for the Oldsmobile 98. At approximately 6 p.m., Rachel's family spotted the car parked on the upper level parking lot of Sears. Inside the locked car were shopping bags and presents, suggesting that the girls had made it back to their vehicle after shopping. But where were they now? Did they maybe drop off their bags and then go back into the mall? Like, as a way to lighten their load? The family went into the mall looking for the three girls, but you can imagine how busy the mall was just 2 days before Christmas. It would have been impossible to find anyone in that crowd. The mall even paged the young girls, but they didn't come forward. By evening, all three families were worried, wondering where their daughter was. They checked hospitals and called all of the girls' friends, but it gave them no answers. Finally, at 11 p.m., with no word from their girls, the families went to the police station to report them missing. That evening, the police weren't too concerned. The girls had only been missing a few hours. They told the parents that they had probably met up with some friends and would return soon, or maybe they had run away. But the families were sure that this was not the case. It didn't make sense that the two older girls would have ran away if they had Julianne with them. And I agree. I think if it were just the two teenage girls, I'd be a little more inclined to consider the possibility that they could have gone off with friends or spontaneously run away. But Julianne kind of put a hole in that theory. The families also pointed out that the three girls didn't take anything with them. They even left their car behind, which was not a good sign. Deep down, the parents knew something bad had happened. After reporting the girls missing, the police went to the mall parking lot to take a look at Rachel's car. They quickly looked through the car and determined that there was no sign of struggle. With that, they released the car back to Rachel's husband, Tommy. The car was never fully investigated and fingerprints were never taken. However, the police, to this day, still say that they handled the investigation the best they could. The families of the three girls, though, disagree. That night, Renee's father watched the mall parking lot from a nearby roof, waiting to see if anyone would return to the car. But nobody did. The next morning was Christmas Eve morning, but warm wishes and happy holidays were the last thing on the family's minds. They couldn't eat, they couldn't sleep. They just wanted to know where their daughters were. Police made a statement to the press saying that although they didn't have any reason to suspect foul play, they still encouraged anyone to come forward with information to help ease the family's anxieties. But then, later that same day, Tommy, Rachel's husband, called police with some information. He told them that he had just discovered a letter in the mailbox. A letter from Rachel. The letter arrived in an envelope. The address written on the outside had been written in pencil. Inside, a letter, supposedly from Rachel, written in pen. There were so many strange things about this letter. First of all, the letter was addressed to Thomas A. Trelisa. But Rachel had always called her husband Tommy. So why all of a sudden was this letter so formal? Inside, the letter read, quote, "I know I'm gonna catch it, but we just had to get away. We're going to Houston. See you in about a week. The car is in the Sears upper lot. Love, Rachel." End quote. However, Tommy quickly noticed that it appeared the letter had originally been signed R-A-C-H-E-E, so Rachy, and then someone had written an L over the last E. Again, this is weird because that suggests that Rachel had written her own name wrong and then had to correct herself. It also just didn't make sense that she would run away to Houston. Like, did she take Renee and Julianne with her? I find it bizarre that the other girls aren't mentioned in the letter. I mean, I guess it does say we. So is that supposed to imply that all three girls needed to get away for a week? Also, if you are going to take off for a week, why choose the week of Christmas? Especially a 9-year-old. Like, what 9-year-old is going to run away over Christmas? It wasn't clear where the letter had been mailed from, as there was no city name on the postmark. However, there was a blurred postal service number on the envelope. Police were able to make out the number, but weren't sure if the last digit was a 3 or an 8. Depending on which it was, it meant the letter was either postmarked from Throckmorton, 3 hours away, or Weatherford, just 30 minutes away. There is some speculation, though, on whether the letter could have been actually delivered to Tommy's house that fast, as it did arrive not even 24 hours after the girls vanished. However, Deborah was also home at the time that the letter was received, and she did corroborate Tommy's story. When Tommy handed the letter over to police, he told them he was convinced that the letter was not written by Rachel. Despite Tommy's belief, on Christmas Day, in an article of the Fort Worth Telegram, police stated that their handwriting experts had concluded that the letter, the part written in pen, had matched Rachel's handwriting. The envelope, however, the part that was written in pencil, didn't match hers. In fact, it didn't match any of the girls' writing. The police believe that even if it was Rachel's handwriting, that she may have been forced to write it. In the past few decades, though, there has been a lot of back and forth about who wrote the letter. It's now said that the FBI could not match the handwriting to Rachel, and that more recent tests concluded Rachel couldn't be confirmed nor ruled out as the writer because so many experts have said different things. Like I said, the original police said yes, it was her. FBI said inconclusive, and then another handwriting expert said that the letter was written by someone who was right-handed when Rachel was left-handed. So I couldn't really get a straight answer on that. Either way, though, the families had all the same opinion. The girls did not write that letter voluntarily. Mrs. Mosley told the Star-Telegram, quote, "I don't put a lot of stock in the letter. It just doesn't make any sense," end quote. On December 28th, the families made a public plea and read an open letter to their daughters on the news. They said that they did not believe that the girls left voluntarily, but if for some reason that they did, just to call their families immediately. Quote, "There's nothing that we will not do for you," said Renee's mom. A reward fund was quickly set up for any information leading to the recovery of what the media had dubbed the Fort Worth Trio. As the weeks passed, rumors of what happened to the girls spread around town. A store clerk at the mall said that a woman had told him she had seen some men force the girls into his pickup truck while in the parking lot. But police were never able to find this woman and therefore couldn't do much with that information. Then there was another story of someone apparently seeing the girls getting into a security patrol car. Again, these witnesses were never confirmed. A week after the disappearances, a truck driver came forward and told police he was absolutely positive that he saw the three young girls hitchhiking in Arkansas. But police thought that Arkansas was just too far from Texas, so it didn't really seem likely that it was them. The best lead police got was from a security watchman for Alkin Laboratories. He was working that night and said that a car containing three young girls and two men pulled into his parking lot. He went to go investigate the car and ask what they were doing, but as he got close, the car sped off. Obviously, detectives had no proof that this car had anything to do with the girls' case, but it was all they had. It wasn't long until the families had to ring in the new year without their daughters, without any answers. In January of 1975, a psychic who offered his services for free was brought in. He said he believed that a group of people had taken the girls and that they were being held against their will somewhere near a lake. I'm not sure how thoroughly the investigators looked into this, but either way, it didn't produce any further leads. Then on January 8th, the family's hopes were raised when someone called Renee's parents and told them that the missing girls would be arriving on a Greyhound bus from Houston at 7:25 p.m. The families rushed to the bus station and waited to greet their daughters, but they never came off the bus. Police assumed that this was probably a prank caller preying on the family's vulnerability. A few weeks after this incident, police were actually able to identify a 14-year-old girl who had been making prank calls to the family. And she was just one of the many people who were calling these parents and either pretending to be the girls or have the girls hostage. That's just one of the things that makes my blood boil. It's an awful thing to do. To give the families false hope that their kid is still alive because you want to have some entertainment or be funny in front of your friends? While police believe that all of these calls were pranks, Julianne's mother says that one of the calls was from her daughter. According to Mrs. Mosley, she received a call and the person on the other line said, "Mama, Mama." And Julianne always called her mom, Mama. So this stuck out to her. When Mrs. Mosley asked if it was Julie, the voice on the other line said yes, and then the call was cut off. There is no proof that it was actually Julie, but Mrs. Mosley believed it was her daughter up until her death. By February of 1975, the reward had grown to $4,000. And with the lack of information coming in, the families decided to hire a private detective by the name of Joseph Swaim. Swaim constantly had tips to investigate, but a big one came in early April of 1975, when an unnamed source apparently told him that the girls' bodies were under a bridge in a neighboring county. Police followed up the tip and had the bridges searched, but the efforts proved futile. Though hope was heightened again, when on April 24th, skeletal remains of at least two teenage females were found in San Antonio, Texas. At the time, many assumed this was it. It was the bodies of the girls, and they would finally get some answers. But days later, they were able to confirm through dental records that they were not the bodies of any of the three girls. And again, the case went cold. The next few years, police chased every lead. There was a tip in March 1976 from a man in Hawaii who claimed that someone had killed the girls and dumped them in an oil well in Rising Star. Fort Worth police brought their team to the oil wells and searched, but all they found were animal bones. A month later, in April 1976, human remains were found in a marshy area near Alvin, a city in the Houston metropolitan area. At that time, the remains they found were only small bones, so it was impossible to find out the identities. But the medical examiner guessed that they had found the remains of three teens. However, he also said it appeared that the remains were that of two women and one man. Despite that, many suggested it was the remains of the missing trio, and believed that until 1981, when police went back to the area and recovered more human remains, enough to collect more info about the victims. The medical examiner then corrected himself. Now, with more bones, he said he believed the bones were actually from three young females. This only further pushed the theory that the remains were the three girls. However, finally, in April of 1981, 5 years after those remains were found, medical examiners confirmed it was not the three girls. Two of the bodies were actually determined to be Brooks Bracewell and Georgia Gear, two preteen girls who are believed to be victims of an unknown serial killer. As for the third body, police never released more information about it, so I don't know what happened with that. But with this new talk about the case, a man came forward with a tip. He lived out of town, so he wasn't super familiar with the case, but once it was again in the news in 1981, he remembered something. He had been visiting Fort Worth the week of the girls' disappearances, and he says he was at the mall that day. He told police he had seen a man force three girls into a van in the mall parking lot. It was making quite a commotion, so the man went over to the van and asked what was going on. Then, the man who was forcing the girls into the van told the witness to back off, because it was a family matter. The witness didn't really read too much into this and decided just to mind his own business. He didn't know that he could have witnessed the abduction of the Fort Worth trio. Unfortunately, even with this tip, police couldn't do much. After all, this was 8 years later, and I doubt the witness remembered what the man looked like or could recite a license plate. Again, the case was put back on the shelf. Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. And we're back. In 1995, 20 years after the girl's disappearance, Rachel's younger brother, Rusty, who is now in his 30s, has spent years trying to get answers. He decided it was time to hire another private investigator, Dan James. Dan James told Rusty that he was familiar with the case and he had been doing his own research for years. The disappearances had torn Rachel's family apart. Family members blamed one another and they argued over what they believed happened. Rusty believed his sister was still alive, as throughout the 1990s, alleged sightings of Rachel were reported in Fort Worth. And some of these tips were even from people that Rachel knew. So you can see why Rusty thought they would have been credible. Sightings were reported multiple times over the year, but strange enough, these sightings were always around Christmas time. Rusty and the private investigator Dan James wondered if Rachel was still alive and only returned to the area around Christmas. And that was why people always reported seeing her in December. However, I kind of feel like since they went missing around Christmas time, the case is probably more present in people's minds during that time of year. Like maybe they saw the case on the news again and it was fresh in their minds. So when they see a woman who resembles Rachel, they're more likely to report it. That's just my opinion, though. Back then, Rusty truly believed Rachel was alive. He doesn't anymore. He says he has accepted that his sister is most likely dead. However, he does believe that someone close to one of the girls had something to do with it. And I'll talk about this more when I get into the theories. After this new private detective began working on the case, it got new attention. Dan James even offered a $25,000 reward out of his own pocket if the case were to ever be solved. This inspired police, who in 2001, more than 25 years after the disappearances, reopened the investigation. They announced that they planned to test some DNA and that they had new witnesses to interview. Also, just some fresh pair of eyes on the case is always a good idea. Later that year, investigators told the media that they had limited their suspect list down to 5 people. Things actually started to look promising, especially when police followed up on a promising lead. Bill Hutchins was a security guard at the Mall Sears at the time of the girl's disappearance. He reported to police in 1974 that he had seen 3 girls inside a pickup truck with a security guard. Back then, this lead was never investigated. But now, police decided to actually look into this story. Also remember, there was another witness who said they saw the girls with a security guard. I mentioned that super briefly at the beginning of the investigation. Police were able to actually track down the security guard that Hutchins said he saw with the girls that night, but this security guard denied ever meeting the 3 girls. On top of trying to find DNA, police also had age-progressed photos made of what the girls may look like as adults in their 30s and 40s. Sometime during the 2000s, I couldn't find an exact date, but police were able to find DNA on the letter. I assume this DNA was probably saliva used to seal it, but they never disclosed that. With this DNA, they were able to confirm it did not come from any of the girls. I'm not sure if they were able to find out if a man or woman licked the envelope. I imagine they could tell that if they actually had a full DNA profile. But again, they kept quiet about what kind of DNA they have. All they said is that it doesn't match the girls. The most recent step in the case came in 2018, when Rusty Arnold, Rachel's younger brother, organized a dive team to investigate some cars that had been found in the bottom of Benbrook Lake, a lake near the mall where the group was last seen. The dive team found 3 cars at the bottom of this lake. The first 2 were brought up to the surface and were determined not to be related to the case. The 3rd car, though, was so degraded that when they tried to bring it up to the surface, it crumbled into pieces and fell back down to the lake. So the divers weren't able to bring it up after that. But in July of 2020, they had a new strategy. They thought if they can't bring the car to them, divers would go down to the car. They haven't found anything of evidence yet, but they say that they're not giving up. Currently, the case is unsolved. Bodies have never been found. Not even a clue. But let's get into a couple theories. Number 1. One of the most interesting and controversial theories is that Rachel's sister Deborah was involved. Over the years, Deborah has been alienated from her family, as some members of the family believe Deborah knows more than she's letting on. In January of 2000, in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the families of the three girls pleaded that Deborah come forward and tell police and FBI what she knows. Some believe that it was Deborah herself who wrote the letter. It's even theorized that maybe Deborah and Tommy planned something together. After all, they were the ones who discovered this mysterious letter. Tommy also remarried a year and a half after Rachel disappeared, and some say that was way too fast. Wouldn't you wait a bit longer to see if your wife was going to come back? But Deborah is adamant she has no idea where her sister is and was not involved. Besides suspicions, there is no evidence connecting her to the case. And I want to be clear that Tommy and Deborah have never been declared suspects. I also feel that if there were DNA evidence on the letter and handwriting evidence, couldn't police have used that to eliminate Deborah? So that theory I'm kind of undecided on. I know that Rachel, Tommy, and Deborah did have a weird situation, but I still think there's a huge jump to assume that she'd murdered her sister and her sister's friends. Let's move on to theory number two, the theory of the sex trafficking ring. To fully understand this theory, I'm going to have to give you a bit of background information. So here goes. On July 10th, 1991, a young woman was found dead at a motel in El Dorado, Arkansas. She had been shot to death by her ex-boyfriend, James McAlphin. The trouble was, though, was that police had a difficult time identifying who she was. Her ex-boyfriend James said that he only knew her as Mercedes, and he didn't know her real name or really anything about her past. Upon further investigation, it was discovered that this woman had used stolen social security cards to create false identities in the past years. So, despite their best efforts, police couldn't figure out the real name of this victim. They decided to call her El Dorado Jane Doe. This Jane Doe was estimated to be about 18 to 30. At the time of her death, she had been working at a strip club in the area and had told her co-workers there that she was originally from Florida and that she had previously had a baby that was later taken away from her. But that's all the clues that police had. But then, after James McAlphin was arrested for Mercedes' murder, he told cops he actually knew more than he had let on. He then tells police a story of how Mercedes was abducted when she was 16 years old and put into sex work. By his recollection, police are able to piece together that Mercedes was probably born around 1961, meaning she was kidnapped in 1977, just 3 years after the Fort Worth trio vanished. So how does El Dorado Jane Doe fit in with the Fort Worth trio? Well, the same guy, James McAlphin, claimed that Jane Doe, or Mercedes, was only one of the many young girls who had been kidnapped and forced into the sex ring. To be clear, he didn't run the sex ring, but he knew of it, and although he denies it, it seems like he was some of the girls' pimps. He tells the police that Mercedes was very good friends with the Fort Worth trio, because she was around the same age as Renee. According to him, the four girls became so close with one another, almost like sisters. But the story doesn't end there. He has more to say. James McAlphin then says that Julianne, the youngest girl, later died in childbirth. As for Renee and Rachel, he alleges that they stayed loyal to their kidnapper and are now part of the operation themselves. He finishes his confession or speech or whatever you want to call it by saying, "Once you do identify Mercedes, her identification is going to help so many other cold cases." Which makes me think that this was all part of something bigger. And maybe Mercedes holds the key to solving it. Now, this guy could be a total bullshitter, and he's not really willing to give any more clues to this mystery. I think at one point he was trying to get money for this confession, but yeah, I don't think police ever made a deal with him. That being said, this is still a very much an active case, and they are still taking steps to identify the El Dorado Jane Doe, There's so much more about her case. If you guys are interested, I can maybe do a mini about her sometime in the future, because really, it deserves its own episode. But without further ado, let's move on to theories 3 and 4. The theory of a serial killer. One theory that seems to pique people's interest is that James Mitchell DeBartolabin is responsible. DeBartolabin is a convicted kidnapper, rapist, counterfeiter, and a suspected serial killer. The media dubbed him the Mall Passer because he was known to go into malls with counterfeit bills, buy something small with that fake bill, and then collect all the change and get a profit. Once he was arrested for this in 1983, police found evidence of his sex crimes and were able to link him to several rapes and kidnappings. Most interesting, though, is the way that he was known to lure his victims, pretending to be a police officer or different kinds of law enforcement. Remember, 2 people said they saw the victims with a security officer. Also, of course, there is the fact that he was known to frequent malls for counterfeiting purposes. His first known victim, like a crime that he was committed for, was a woman whom he had kidnapped and sexually assaulted in 1978. But police say his crime started back in the 60s, and he is a suspect in many murders, including the Fort Worth Trio. As I mentioned, he is only a suspected serial killer, but police are pretty sure this guy is responsible for many horrific murders, including the brutal murder of his real estate agent. So why does this theory fit? Well, he traveled to many malls across the United States, and get this, at the time of the girls' disappearances, he was living with his parents in Fort Worth, only a half mile away from Rachel's house. Also, his way is dressing up as law enforcement, and the girls were seen with a security patrol car. Unfortunately, though, he can't give us any answers himself because he's now dead. So with that, let's move on to number 4, the theory of Edward Harold Bell. Edward Harold Bell was a convicted murderer and child predator. He was known to flash little kids and just be a disgusting creep. In 1998, he was imprisoned for shooting and killing a man back in 1978, when he confessed through a series of letters to an attorney that he had killed 11 young girls between 1971 and 1977 all over Texas. He referred to these victims as, quote, the 11 that went to heaven, end quote. He did give a few names, but he couldn't remember all of his supposed victims' names. And while he didn't name the Fort Worth Trio, many wonder if they were 3 of his 11 victims. In the 70s, Bell was a traveling salesman, so it would make sense that he was all over Texas. However, a few years ago, he said in an interview that he made the confession up in an attempt to get the death penalty. I honestly don't know what to believe with this guy. He's very mentally ill and he's a pathological liar, so I don't think his confession means a ton. However, I also don't think it should be ruled out. Though, just like DeBartolabin, Bell is also dead, so we won't be getting more answers from him. The final theory is the theory of the unknown suspect, and for that I obviously don't have much. Some believe that it was a real security guard who took the girls. Some think they were forced into sex slavery, but that has nothing to do with James McAlphin's story. And some have a theory that they were taken to Mexico. So what do you guys think is the best theory? Which one makes most sense to you? Feel free to let me know, and if you guys have any other theories too, you can post about it in the Always Time for True Crime discussion group. And I'm going to put that link in my show notes. As always, thanks for listening and supporting indie podcasts.